We're in Ecclesiastes. If you have your Bibles, turn there. As I'm actually really glad this day has come. We're done with Ecclesiastes after today. Really glad. It's I don't know about you guys, but it just seems like it's been saying the same thing over and over and over again. But then I was reminded about something in my reading that, you know, when a serious person in the congregation goes and listens to a sermon, they only hear about 2 minutes of it anyway, so you probably aren't getting what I'm saying. That's just the way we operate. You know, our minds go someplace, we connect. I think if we could all listen to the same 2 minutes, we could be done really fast, right? If all we get is 2 minutes, let's all do it at the same time, and then we're over. No, just kidding. But good to be with you this morning. We had an opportunity to be at a family reunion last weekend, and it was great to get connected, to have our granddaughter Ella with us and have her get the chance to meet her great-grandmother and the rest of the family. It was really fun. Vicki flew on to North Carolina met Ella and Micah and Mary back at their home, where she got to spend this past week hanging out with Ella while Micah and Mary were doing a few things. It was really fun for her, and here I am. Wasn't that fun for me, but I missed it. But anyway, flying back on the plane, I was finally reading a book that I'd always heard I should read, and I kind of thought it was one of those books that, you know, was pretty recent. Actually, it was written in about 2000. Maybe you read it. It's Leif Enger's book, Peace Like a River. A good piece of fiction to read if you're into fiction. It's a good thing to read. It broadens the mind. Leif is a great author in terms of like being able to develop a word picture and descriptive stuff. And anyway, in the story, there's a family, a dad, two sons, and a daughter. And the older son doesn't commit murder, but he kills a couple young men who intruded into their home, and then gets arrested and breaks out of prison and becomes this nationwide manhunt for this young guy, 16-year-old. And in the midst of this young manhunt, the family kind of goes after their son as well, just to kind of figure out and help and whatever. And at first, it's all about trying to connect with him and trying to make sure he's okay and whatever. And then all of a sudden, Dad meets up with an FBI agent, and he has this change of heart, and he decides to help the FBI agent find his son. And Reuben, who is the main character, a 10-year-old boy, just cannot figure that out. I mean, when his dad tells him what he's done, Reuben just can't even fathom that his dad would do that. And when he presses his dad on it, his dad won't talk about it. He won't explain it to him. And one of the things about the book is there are a multitude of really strong statements that are made, but I think this was one of the strongest. It says, as he's trying to figure out how his dad changed the course, he says this: how we hate to wait for things to make sense. How we hate to wait for things to make sense. And I've got to tell you, as I read that, all I could think about is this sermon series that we've been going through in the book of Ecclesiastes. Because Ecclesiastes is actually addressing that very issue. How we hate to wait to try to be able to figure out something and why it happened. You know, that's really the course of life, to be able to look at something and say, how in the world is it true that good things happen to bad people? Or that bad things happen to good people? How in the world can it be true that this joy that I thought I would receive from this happy experience kind of just frivoled away? How can it be that this success that I accomplished actually doesn't bring me the significance that I thought, or the wealth that I was searching after doesn't bring the security? How is it that relational pain and difficulty just keeps flowing into my life? How does this, what is going on here? And then you hear, well, don't worry, one day you'll be able to figure it out. Well, maybe not. And that's really the point of Ecclesiastes, because what Ecclesiastes does, as we said earlier, is deconstruct what we think we know about the world and about our own lives. And when we discover what it is, man, it takes us to our knees, literally. And then the fact that Jesus and the gospel are really good news becomes absolutely apparent to our lives. What Jesus is trying to do with the book of Ecclesiastes is to get us to rethink the world. And when we see the reality of it, that we would actually fall to our knees and want the good news of Jesus Christ. That's the point of Ecclesiastes. That's the point of this whole thing. And when you deconstruct something, you know what has to happen? Something has to take its place. And so what Ecclesiastes 12 does is reconstruct everything that the sermon of the last 11 chapters has deconstructed. Let's take a look. Verse 1 starts this way of chapter 12. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the streets are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low, they are afraid also of what is high and terrors in that way. The almond trees blossom, the grasshoppers drag itself along, and desire fails because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. A lot of questions when I go through the book of Ecclesiastes. And when I get to the conclusion, which we just got to, the preacher, the one who preached 11 chapters, is now being kind of talked about by the narrator. He's saying that this preacher has said all these things and he's made all these statements, but I really want to bring down the conclusion for you. I really want to help you understand clearly. And so the preacher gives way to the narrator, and the narrator says these things. And as I'm looking for the answers to the questions that I've had throughout the entire book of Ecclesiastes, here's what I discover. The narrator gives no answers. The narrator just gives instructions. And those instructions actually become the answer. Remember, we said that the world that is around us and the one that we're living in is vanity. That's how the preacher starts. He makes this statement and says, you know, all these things that you see, everything about this world, it's vanity. And we remind ourselves that vanity is not just meaninglessness. Actually, vanity is a Hebrew word called hevel. And that word is all about smoke, bubbles, or vapor. And the thing about smoke, bubbles, and vapor is that you can see them, and you might even want to grasp onto them, but you can't take them in. And so when you look at life and the way things are in the world, things don't make sense. Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why does success not bring significance? Why does wealth not bring security? Why does a relationship blow apart? Why is that? It doesn't make sense. And every time I get close to it being able to make sense, it floats away. Like I can never really grasp it. Like I can never really understand it. Do you ever feel like that? Do you ever sense that? I mean, that's what Ecclesiastes is telling us. And I'm looking for answers. I want to know. When am I going to know the meaning of life? When am I going to know why I had to endure what I had to endure? And what the sermon says is you might not. But here's how we can help you deal with that. I mean, these three instructions that he gives are simple. Remember, revere, and obey. Now, last week, Lewis stood on this stage from our university, from our Lindale campus. Lewis, the campus pastor at Lindale, stood on this stage and he reminded us that everything about this world looks towards something future, absolutely. And that Jesus Christ, who is now seated at the right hand of God, having sat down, in other words, finished the work of providing us hope and security and peace through his death and his resurrection, he has done everything to reconnect us to God. So everything that we're talking about here has to be seen under the umbrella of the fact that we have a future. But we are still living in today. And how do we deal with today? How do we do the things that God calls us to do? What does it look like for us to be able to live in a world where our response to it is like soap bubbles? I don't know how to deal with it. I don't know how to grasp it. I don't know how to understand it. It doesn't seem to make sense. And the preacher tells us we're supposed to remember, we're supposed to revere, and we're supposed to obey. So let's kind of unpack that just for a little help this morning. Look at verse 1 of chapter 12 again. It says, remember, okay? I mean, there's a strong statement there. I want you to remember. And remember is a pretty simple concept. It's to call to mind or bring back something from your memory. So like when you're taking an exam, you need to call to mind everything that you've studied on the subject so that you can pass the exam. And he's saying you got to remember. And then he says, well, you know, what does this remembering look like? Who am I supposed to remember? What am I supposed to remember? And then when am I supposed to remember? And it starts off pretty simply. He says, here's who you should remember. You need to remember your Creator. Remember your Creator. And now, this is not just an invitation to sit by a mountain or by the beach and to journal about what you wish your Creator would be. Right? This is not some sort of invitation for you to try to figure out or to try to put down or try to create what your image of God should be. We all understand. I mean, I think all of us would be in the same place. Most of us would like the same kind of God. If I was making up who God would be in my life, it would be something like somebody who kind of keeps their distance, doesn't get involved in my life unless I really need them to. Right? It's somebody doesn't make a lot of demands on my life, but also somebody like a DoorDash driver who brings the appropriate meal to my house from Chipotle at the time that I ordered it, right? That's kind of who we want God to be. We want God to be this kind of, not genie, I don't think it's that simple, but we want God to serve us, and we create him in our image. Now, the problem with that is that who this God is the Creator, right? Now, think about that for just a minute. How arrogant, presumptuous, ignorant, and dangerous is it for any of us who were created to divine who the Creator should be? I mean, what right, what logic is there to think that I get to create the one who created me? That doesn't even work. That doesn't even make sense. And so many of us, I do it on a regular basis. A person who's been a pastor for 35 years, a Christian for almost 45, someone who's studied the word and someone who's prayed and someone who's led people towards Christ. And I still have this sense that I want to create God in the image that I want him to be. But that's not the image of God. The image of God is an eternal being, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, who gets to define himself and, in fact, defines himself by his very nature and by his very character. So, the first thing is, we got to remember that God is the creator. Who are we supposed to remember? We're supposed to remember God, the creator. And then, by that, we also have to come to senses. What are we supposed to remember about him? What are we supposed to remember about this creator when things are going in a way that is not like I would anticipate? What am I supposed to remember about God when life is falling apart? When it doesn't make sense? When I'm sitting in the midst of having to wait for it to make sense? What should I know? What should I remember about who God is? And what God is. I mean, I think it's pretty simple. I think it boils down to his nature and his character. And four things specifically. His holiness, his sovereignty, his kindness, and his love. I mean, God is holy. You got to remember that. He's separate from this world fully and completely. I mean, God is not just good, right? I mean, sometimes we think God is really good at things. Actually, God is not good at anything. God is perfect at everything, right? God is not just pretty good at being compassionate. God's not just pretty good at being holy. God's not just pretty good at being loving. God is perfect and complete and full in that. God is not just pretty good at creating a plan and sticking to it. God is perfect at that. And if we don't understand that, then we're going to miss the whole thing about who God is and what he's trying to do. And therefore, our world will remain as a mystery to us. So first, we have to recognize his holiness. And then we have to recognize his sovereignty, his plan, his will. And while we look at this world and while we see sin, brokenness, everything happening around us, one of the things that we learn about that is that God is allowing that brokenness to run its course. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I think about the world, when I look and see what happens on a daily basis in our world today, whether it's another mass shooting, whether it's some other terrible and awful thing that happened, like the train crash in India, or some weather thing that took place, or some new diagnosis of a friend, or some relationship that breaks up, or the street person walking along without any hope and desperate. I mean, all these things, and we could go on and on and on about the way our brokenness shows up in the world. And God's allowing that in his sovereign plan. He's allowing sin to run its course, and one day all things will be new. But until that day, everything that he allows, he redeems. Everything, every broken aspect of the world that he allows to run forward, he's going to redeem. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that everything's going to get better for all of us before we die. That's not the point of that. Here's what the point is that somehow, and I'm not sure how, God is going to get glory from everything that is broken and everything that goes on in the world. That means the crisis that you've been through or maybe going through right now, the pain that you're enduring or the struggle or the difficulty that you're enduring, everything that's going on in your life, God is going to get glory for that. And that is what this world is about. God's glory. Now, it may seem so much like, how could you put me through that to get your glory, Lord? And I get it. And that's really what hevel is. I mean, it doesn't make sense. But if I have a relationship with the eternal God of the universe who is deserving of worship, who is the only true lover and kind one, then I begin to understand life a little bit better. I mean, if I didn't have God's kindness and his love to go along with his sovereignty and his holiness, this would be a tough life. I mean, if all I had to do was to stand with my face to the wind and gut it out, I wouldn't last very long, and neither would you. But if I've got the kindness of God in the midst of those things, the compassion of God in the midst of those things, and I can press into the one who perfectly offers me that compassion, man, now that's something. If I've got a God who loves me, and I understand that and know that, like John 3:16 says, that God so loved the world, God so loves me, God so loves you, that he would offer his only son for the forgiveness of our sin so that we could have eternal life with him and a new life right now. I mean, there's something to that. There's everything to that. And we have misunderstandings about the way things are and the way things should be working and the pain and the struggle that go along with that. But in the kindness of God and in the love of God, he's offered to comfort us. And unfortunately, too many times, we turn our backs on his comfort instead of pressing into his comfort. We got to remember who we're talking about here, the Creator, and what he's like. Holy, sovereign, kind, and loving. But also, we got to address when to remember. Look back at verse 1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Now, none of us are getting any younger, right? And it doesn't mean necessarily that that if you didn't do it when you were young, you missed it. Basically, what he's saying in this passage is get to it right away. Start remembering God right away. Start remembering God in this moment. Why? Well, because you're going to discover that the world doesn't make sense. Look at verse 1. You're going to discover that the evil days are going to come and the years are going to draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. You need to remember God before you experience the truth that good things don't always bring joy that you expect, right? Look at verse 2. He says, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. Man, what he's saying is you need to remember who and what God is before the rain ruins the plan you had for today or something else ruins it. You need to remember before you have to go through those things that make you think this is hevel, this is vanity. Look at verse 3. You need to remember who God is before. Man, before you get old, look at verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few. Grinders in this context are teeth. Old people lose their teeth, right? Those who look through windows that are dimmed. I mean, who of us who are getting just a tad bit older than 30 have perfect eyesight anymore, right? Look at verse 4, and the doors of the street are shut, the ears, right? Man, you don't hear when you get older. When the sound of the grinding is low and room rises up at the sound of the bird and all the songs of the daughters are brought low. What is he saying? He's saying, man, you better learn and remember who God is before you get to the place that you're almost dead, because you're going to experience all these things that produce a thought in you that everything is hevel because it just doesn't make sense. Before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowl is broken or the pitcher shattered at the fountain or the wheel is broken at the cistern, before everything you have gathered up wears out, breaks down, or gives out, man, you gotta know that God is who he is. You want to make sense of the world, you got to know who God is. You want to make sense of difficulty, you got to know who it, and be, whether it's a huge thing or a small thing. We're flying back from, on Tuesday, we were flying back, I told you that already, from Ohio, and on Wednesday, I got an email from the airlines, and all it was in the subject line was, how was your flight? And I thought, man, the flight was awesome. You know, I got on, we boarded on time, I said it was only about a third full, and so the seat between me and the guy at the window made it feel like first class, and kind of, you know. And then the flight took off, and we were 20 minutes early, landed in Dallas. The flight was awesome. The problem wasn't the flight. The problem was it was Tuesday night, we had a thunderstorm, and every plane at DFW had been grounded until we were like 20 minutes from the airport. And so when we landed, there were about 100 planes on the tarmac waiting for a gate to open up, and we sat on that plane for over 2 hours. Yeah, I know, thank you. It was so terrible. It was horrible. It was awful. It was, and I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking, come on, God, I had plans. I mean, this is so stupid, right? So I just spent 2 days with my cousin Jason, the guy who last in January that I've told you about, who was paralyzed in the ski accident. And I'm thinking to myself, even as I'm discouraged and spent and trying to figure it out, which sounds so dramatic, but you know how you get in that moment. It felt like the biggest thing in the world to me, even though my cousin is just trying to figure out how he lives life as a now in a wheelchair. And here I am worried about sitting on an airplane for 2 hours with, you know, them bringing us drinks. You know, I had 3 or 4 orange juices. I mean, it wasn't that bad. Finished my book. But that's, you know, it's all relative, isn't it? And we're going through these things, and it doesn't make sense to us at the time. And what God's saying is, you got to remember, I got something bigger. You got to remember that I'm in the midst of this, and you don't need to be so whacked out about it. You need to trust me more. So we remember. And then you skip down to verse 13, and you see something else, the end of the matter. In other words, here's the conclusion, 2 things, fear God and obey God. Fear him. In other words, reverence him. I mean, in the midst of whatever's going on in this world, would you keep God as God? To reverence God, or to fear God, can mean to a certain extent that you fear accountability, which is true. You should. I mean, who of us who doesn't inadvertently run a stop sign? I said inadvertently. Who of us who doesn't inadvertently run a stop sign look around, right? What are we looking for? It's so weird. When I've done that in the past, I don't look around to see if other cars were there. What I look around for is there a police car about to stop me, right? Because we fear accountability. And there's a certain amount of fear that we should have because of who God is. But fear in this sense isn't that kind of fear necessarily or limited. It's also just this awe-inspiring reverence of God, the only one who deserves that reverence. You know, I don't know what your music style is, so whether we had Pavarotti on our stage along with Bruce Springsteen and Adele and, you know, Taylor Swift or whoever, and they began to sing, you know, here in this morning, you would be blown away. I would be blown away, right? I would be awe-inspired, right, by especially Springsteen. But if Jesus was on this stage with them, what would happen? They would immediately be eliminated and irrelevant, right? Because Jesus is the only one that demands our reverence. Jesus is in the midst of everything else that we have, in the midst of everything else the world has to offer, Jesus is the only one that demands, that actually deserves us giving him worship. And so, part of living in this world is keeping him as our object of that worship. And then, finally, we got to keep his commandments. And this is not about earning favor before God, because the only way to earn favor before God is to receive his gift of forgiveness, the death and resurrection of his son by faith. That's the only way to receive favor. But when we keep his commands, here's what we do. In the midst of all the stuff that we don't understand, we're aligning with him. We're saying no matter what's going on, it's best to live by your word. No matter what I'm experiencing, no matter what I'm feeling, no matter what I'm going through at this moment, it's best to live according to your word. It aligns us with him. But it also puts us in this place of what we were made to do, which is to worship him. Because every time I choose to obey God instead of myself, I am proclaiming to him that he's my God. That I love him more than I love myself. And you know what? That's why we were made. That's what our purpose is. And so what's really weird in this whole thing is that maybe what makes sense about the life we're living that doesn't make sense, maybe by worshiping him through obedience, actually makes it make sense. Because life is not about us. It's about him. So it only makes sense to remember him, to revere him, and to obey him. God, we thank you for what you've done in our lives, for how you're doing it. And even though it's hard, and I know in this room there are a lot of struggles that, man, I couldn't even begin to fathom, and a lot of pain. But you are in control. You are kind. You are loving. You are in charge. And you are using it to bring yourself glory, which is the point of this world. And I pray, Lord, that you would help us to align underneath that. In Jesus' name, amen.